Hey there, Joshua here.
Hey, Joshua. Daniel out of the Edge Television Broadcast.
How you doing, Daniel?
Man, if I was any better, I'd be illegal, Joshua.
I hear you, man. It's great to talk to you.
Well, you know, I was talking about clones. I was talking about in Ranting Points. I don't know if you was able to watch or hear that, but in Ranting Points, I was talking about the UK clone. But, you know, the scientists have come to me, Joshua. They want to clone me, believe it or not, because I actually won Times Person of the Year, and they want to clone me, so there's a lot of fill the earth with Daniel Lotz.
Well, I got no problem with that. I mean, I don't know you that well, but hopefully it'll be a good decision.
Okay. Hey, well, welcome to the first time on the Edge broadcast, Joshua. And I got to tell you, I'm just going to start right. I'm going to dig right in because we got a lot to talk about. But the first I ever heard of you, and man, I've been doing this show since 2004, so I don't know how you got off my radar. I don't know why you weren't on my radar. You should have been a long time ago. But my wife and I was watching Alien Abduction. And then I saw you on there, and I thought, and we just fell in love with the movie, okay? And I was telling Chase Klosky when she was on the program and other people that that's one of the movies that we watch when we go camping is Alien Abduction.
You know, it's funny because I did a search on my email for your name, and we first started corresponding 10 years ago. Can you believe that?
Really?
Yeah, in 2009. And we were always having these scheduling conflicts, you know, to try to get together. But, you know, Alien Abduction is one of those really bizarre it was not an independent film, but it almost was, because Lawrence Bender was one of the producers on that. And, of course, Lawrence Bender, he has produced many of Quentin Tarantino's works, Pulp Fiction, of course, being the big one. But he's a huge producer in Hollywood. And so I was contacted all those years ago by a filmmaker, Maddie Beckerman, who said, I want to do a movie that is kind of like a mockumentary and based around the Brown Mountain Lights phenomenon. And it was originally called Project Blue Book, which honestly, those two don't really overlap. But so what he decided to do was to interview me and other people who are experts or authentic witnesses, and then sort of weave us into this mockumentary found footage type format film. And of course, it eventually became this thing called Alien Abduction, which is a more appropriate name. But what I thought was so strange is that to this day, I still get calls and emails from people who believe that's a documentary. They don't realize that this was fiction. Wow. They think that that's real.
Wow.
Yeah, but it's not. It's not. I mean, there. It's based in reality, but there are a lot of exaggerations in terms of how many people disappear and get abducted, and there are real abductions there. But when they interviewed me, I gave an honest interview, and they just did a great job of seamlessly including it in the rest of their content.
They did. That was an outstanding movie, and we watch it all the time. And I'm gonna quote one of the guys that sort of a civilian guy in the very beginning. He's like a kind of a woodworker guy. He says, talk about the lights. He goes, they seem to move about in a ghost-like manner.
Well, you know, one of the weird things about Brown Mountain is, okay, I was born and raised in Asheville, North Carolina, which is the heart of the Blue Ridge Mountains right there in western North Carolina. And, you know, North Carolina is a very diverse state. You have the mountains in the west and the flat Piedmont in the middle, and then you have the coast. And I could drive, you know, 45, 50 minutes and be in Burke County. And actually, Brown Mountain sort of sits on the border of Burke and Caldwell counties there in the Pisgah National Forest. So as soon as I turned 16 and got my driver's license, that was a big thing. You know, I would drive there as frequently as possible with my friends and not only go to overlooks and watch the mountain, but also I ended up for a period of over 15 years getting these permits from the National Forest Service and going there and camping out and bringing tons of scientific instrumentation, getting keys to open service roads so we could really get back into some remote areas. I camped out over the years with a lot of different scientists. I brought a physicist from the Oak Ridge National Laboratory in Tennessee, a professional geologist who does work for the United Nations. I'm telling you, like, every type of scientist you can imagine, park rangers. I brought all these people there, and we camped with them and had them sort of look at the work that we were doing and give us their advice and reinforce it. And all that said, what I can tell you is that after 15 years of research, Brown Mountain to this day is what I call a phantasmagoria of paranormal phenomena. So you have people who go there and they say, I've seen a ghost. Other people say, I've seen a UFO and I've been abducted. Other people say, I've seen a monster or a cryptid or an interdimensional being of some kind. Other people go there and they talk about experiencing time slips. You have all this stuff that's centered around this particular area, the Linville area, and so it's kind of like a miniature Bermuda Triangle. Wow. And even though I think the lights themselves are probably a plasma similar to ball lightning, I think that's just one of the natural byproducts from a place that creates that level of energy. But you have to understand that kind of a spot that creates that natural geologic or cosmic energy also spawns a lot of these other things, these paranormal phenomena that we are still having trouble trying to classify and categorize.
Now, how do you live in the mountains, being born and raised in the mountains that long? And have you seen Bigfoot in there too as well?
I've never seen what I can conclusively say is a Bigfoot. Now, I will tell you that when I was a really small kid, I was probably about 4 years old, I did at my grandmother's house way back in the mountains. She had a lot of property. I did one night see a figure outside of her shed that I thought at the time looked like a Bigfoot because it had red eyes and it was easily 6-7 feet tall. And I only got sort of a half view of it, though, because it was sort of standing next to her shed. And at that time, I was convinced that I'd seen some type of a big bipedal dark creature, which I later would consider to be something like a Bigfoot. But now, at this point in my life, I've learned so much about the possibilities that I can't look back through my four-year-old eyes and and say that, you know, what I saw was a Bigfoot. But that would be the closest experience that I've had in my life to possibly seeing something like that. And of course, I know a lot of cryptozoologists, you know, Lauren Coleman. I've known him for a long time, and I've been in the field, and I've done a lot of different investigations. But I personally have never seen something with clarity that would match the description of some sort of a giant normal biological organism like a big ape that's running around this country.
Let me ask you, I was reading some of your material on that, and I think somewhere you suggest that it is possible that these lights or orbs, whatever they are, could actually follow people based on their own electrical energy.
Yeah, there are many, many cases that would seem to substantiate this. As a matter of fact, and I interviewed one guy named Tommy Hunter, who in 1982 was there at the Overlook, which is the most popular overlook off of Highway 181 right next to Brown Mountain. He was there with, I think almost at least 8, 9, 10 different people. And at They're standing there in the evening looking at the mountain, and all of a sudden this ball of light that looks like it's a little bigger than a basketball, hovering about 3 feet over the ground, it just sort of drifts up from the valley between the overlook and the ridge, because Brown Mountain is it's a low-lying ridge that's about 2,600 feet in elevation on average. And this ball of light came up, and it freaked everybody out, and everybody ran the other way except for Tommy, who was an auto mechanic, and he went walking up toward it, and they're screaming at him and saying, "You crazy man!" It kind of reminds you of that scene in the film Fire in the Sky. You know, yeah. When Travis Walton is supposedly going toward the UFO. So everybody's saying, "What are you doing?" And he went up and he put out his hand and he touched it, and he said it felt like an electrical shock. It actually. He pretty much passed out for a few seconds. And so after that, the thing sort of drifted away. On other occasions, we've had people who say they've been at that same overlook, and one of these balls of light appeared, and it scared them, and they hit the accelerator and got out of there, and the ball of light would follow them for maybe a mile or two behind their car. And so there is certainly a record of interaction between these balls of light and individuals. And I could go on with examples and case stories, but most people who have had that experience say they get the sense that there's something conscious and intelligent about these lights, as opposed to it simply being a matter of field interaction. And that is to say, if you have an electrical field and you move toward it, it might move away from you, and then you walk away from it and it moves towards you because there's an attraction there that's similar to a magnetic interaction. That could be mistaken for something conscious, but most people say they get the feeling that many of these lights actually do possess some kind of consciousness and follow them around.
Now, I was watching a video that was on your Facebook. I think it was filmed in Las Vegas. And looking at the lights in that video, it kind of looks like it's a craft in that particular case. Did you get that feeling?
Well, there are many examples of this. I mean, when it comes to, say, the Brown Mountain area, okay, Brown Mountain, obviously, is a mountain. Then, on the other hand, you have places like Hestland, Norway, where you have a valley where lights appear. And then you have the Las Vegas area, which is also a valley. I mean, people don't realize usually that Las Vegas is a valley. I mean, I am here in the Nevada area right now, and we have mountains on either side, well, certainly one, the western side of Las Vegas, that are 12,000 feet in elevation. So, you know, they're snow-capped. And so this is a valley here. And it seems like when you have some extreme geology, you have mountains or valleys, you have more of a tendency for these kinds of sort of earth lights to appear. And that when these lights appear, we have to ask ourselves, is this, you know, purely a geological effect or some kind of interaction between the geology and the atmosphere that looks like some kind of UFO? Or in some cases, are we dealing with some kind of technology? And here in Las Vegas, I think the video that you're referring to, and there are many of them, was shot recently by a man named Steve Barone, who has become a good friend of mine. So here, if you've never been to Las Vegas, for those listening who never have, the Las Vegas Strip more or less runs from north to south. And on the western side, you have this very dynamic, mountainous, rocky area called the Red Rock Cliffs. And on the edge of that lives this man named Steve Barone, who's retired now. And he has a house with a big deck with a just beautiful, sweeping, majestic view of the entire Las Vegas Valley and everything around it. And almost every night he goes out onto his deck with a variety of cameras and he films the lights around here. And over the years he has gained just unbelievable experience, because this is one of the brightest cities in the world. You know, you have obviously your typical helicopters and drones and airplanes, but we also have all the, you know, fireworks and all the crazy, like we have a Luxor Hotel shooting the big light in the sky. He can tell the difference between all those things. Mm-hmm. And I've been in the field with him, and he is excellent at being able to discern what's normal and what is abnormal. And he has hours and hours and hours of incredible footage of these illuminations that often look like some kind of craft that is at very least exotic flying around here. And you have to understand, Daniel, that the government owns 86% of Nevada, more than any other state. And we are – it's a big state, but it's a big – especially military experimentation state. Mm-hmm. And so it's possible that some of the lights that we see flying around here are well, they could be military technology that's based on what they've retrieved from alien technology, which, you know, that's a whole other conversation we can dig into if you want. Or some of these could be actual alien interactions that we're seeing, but there are a lot of things happening right here, and the video you're referring to, I'm sure, is one of Steve Barone's most recent captures.
I was on a sort of a ghost hunt at a cemetery about 2 a.m. in the morning, and somebody had took a picture of just the dark there, and when they looked at it on the camera, what I could perceive, it looked to be about a 3-foot blue plasma-like ball. And I'm wondering, why is it, Joshua, have you got any understanding about why sometimes you can't see them visibly, but they can be picked up by a camera?
Oh, sure. Well, you know, all cameras, pretty much speaking, are naturally sensitive to infrared light, at very least, that is otherwise invisible to the naked eye. So, for example, anybody listening right now, you can take your cell phone or any kind of a digital camera that you have and then find a remote control, say a remote control for just your television. And chances are when you hit the button on your remote control, you're either going to see nothing with your naked eye or you might see a little red glow. But if you look at that same thing through your phone or your digital camera, you will see a substantial light, often a flashing light, that is coming from the remote control. And this is just one example of how that the processors, the original ones, we used to call them CCDs, charge coupled devices, are able to perceive infrared light. And it goes the same for UV light. Of course, every camera is unique. I mean, cameras are usually, in general, much more sensitive to infrared than they are ultraviolet. But, I mean, if you go to a photography store, they'll sell you these UV filters that you can put on your camera so that if you're not some weird paranormal photographer like you and I are, you just want a normal-looking picture, you can screw on this ultraviolet filter, and it will make sure that your camera does not pick up that noise, so to speak. So cameras, of course, are always going to have a tendency to pick up a little bit more into the infrared or ultraviolet, especially as we become more and more digitized. And you know what's funny, Daniel, is that if you use some of the cameras, some of the first digital cameras that were coming onto the market about 20 years ago, you are actually liable to get more paranormal photos or video than you are with the new stuff. Wow. Because the new stuff has got this software in it that automatically will detect anomalies and cancel them out, because 99% of the people who are out there taking pictures at a wedding or at a picnic or whatever, they don't want an orb showing up. They don't want some weird mist that's going to screw up their photograph. And so the most sophisticated cameras, ironically these days, are the least likely ones.
Wow.
To pick up a lot of this paranormal phenomena, because the software is filtering that stuff out. And so you really have to know your camera technology if you're going out there trying to photograph these paranormal phenomena.
Mm-hmm. I was looking at the chat there. It said one of the writers says life is less boring with entities flying around. So I would agree. And it sounds to me like you're not leading a very boring life by the looks of your website and the things you've done, Josh. But we got lots and lots of questions coming in. So let's go ahead and give you a few. You ready?
I'm ready.
All right, Peter from Australia. Did you see the CCTV footage of paranormal activity at Tyler Kiln's pub in Canterbury in England?
Well, you know what? I see so much footage that honestly that one does not particularly ring a bell. I mean, to me, it's not that even surprising anymore to see footage from especially pubs and theaters and old houses with objects moving around. Or, I mean, I value that stuff, and I think that it's important for us to document it, but I see so much that I can't tell you I know anything in particular about that.
Yeah, I don't know if that's the one I saw. It seemed like I saw one kind of a black and white one, and a chair goes scooting across, and it's like a swinging door. Somebody comes through. It's pretty crazy stuff. All right, Azur from the live chat. Have you encountered any reports of inner earth portals in that particular area?
Yeah, well, you know, I guess we're talking about Brown Mountain, right? I'll presume that, because at Brown Mountain in Western North Carolina, there are a number of reports about inner earth portals. As a matter of fact, in the 1960s, there was a man who lived there named Ralph Lael. His last name is spelled L-A-E-L. And Ralph Lael, what a story. Okay, so if you can envision the guy, you know, kind of a short, dumpy fellow with a salt and pepper mustache, affable face, and he used to operate this little shop there that was kind of a souvenir shop. That's what he did for a living, and it was called the Outer Space Rock Shop Museum.
Wow.
And he claimed that he would go out at night, and when the lights appeared, he would flash his flashlight at them in certain patterns. You can imagine this being similar to Morse code, and that often the lights would reciprocate, and they would start, you know, responding and with all these blinking things. So over time, he worked out some kind of primitive form of communication with whatever was creating the lights, and they eventually led him to a cliff, and he had to walk down a big long trail, and at the end of the trail, he had this nice big, what appeared to be solid rock face, and then he used their commands, and it turns out a door opened, and he went inside and found himself in what he called a crystal cave. So, and there's no doubt about the fact that quartz crystal is just all over the place around Brown Mountain and the Linville region where Brown Mountain is. And in this crystal cave, he said he met a variety of beings from other planets, and that they actually took him on to a craft, and they flew him around, and they gave him a tour, and told him about the future of mankind. And the funny thing is that people in the community I've talked to have said that they would see Ralph Lael with just a little paper bag with basically a sandwich and chips in it, you know, and he'd go walking off into the woods saying, yeah, I'm going to go see my friends here from space. And he'd be gone for 2 weeks.
Wow. Whoa.
And then he'd come back out of the woods. And he looked, you know, he didn't look like he'd been in the woods for 2 weeks. Let's put it that way.
Wow.
And he talked about all of his experiences. But here's the weirdest thing, Daniel. Okay, in his museum, if you went in there and you paid the guy like a dollar or two, he'd take you into the back room where he had a mummy. And he said this was the mummified body of an alien. And that he had gotten from them as evidence. And so he would show you this body, and you know what? He died before 1970, and honestly, I don't know how he died, but he was still, you know, fairly young. And after that, somebody came in and bulldozed his shop to the ground, and to this day, nobody has any idea what happened to Ralph Lael's little alien mummy. And if you get online and you type in Ralph Lael alien mummy, you'll be able to find one or possibly two pictures. I only know of two pictures that exist of this alien mummy. But that's a very long answer to the question of, do I know anything about inner earth portals? But that is what he said, that Brown Mountain had an inner earth portal.
I like that answer. that was freaking awesome, Joshua. I guess I got a clarification here, because somebody said, how are you watching movies when you're camping? I guess I should clarify. We have a camper with a 40-inch TV. So it's really more like glamping.
Yeah, I've heard that term. Yeah,
it's more like glamping, but still we're in the forest, man. You know, you turn the lights out, still get scary out there. All right, and by the way, have you ever heard of Chase Klosky?
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, I was talking to her not too long ago. We were both being considered for participation in a new TV show.
Oh, awesome. Awesome. I told her about your movie, and she goes, Daniel, I'd live that movie. So, yeah. Wow.
Well, I want to clarify. I mean, it's not really my movie. I mean, Maddie Beckerman made the movie.
Right, right. I didn't mean it's your movie, but you're in that movie. And so I'm sorry. No. I didn't mean to let's clarify that for sure. All right. Then we have this question from Rose. Has anyone seen Gray Aliens around the Brown Mountain Lights? And she says, by the way, I'm a big fan of that movie, too.
There have been sightings of every type of creature that we usually talk about in this field, you know, not just grays, but even things that are weirder, like Pumpkin Man.
Whoa.
Pumpkin Man is this easily 6 foot, 7 foot tall figure with I don't want to say it's exactly a pumpkin head, but just a big, you know, giant, creepy looking jack-o'-lantern head. And I've heard stories about Pumpkin Man also being smaller, though, like 3 feet tall, with kind of these wispy arms and stuff. And so that may be similar to a gray. People have talked about seeing little beings, almost like fairies, inside one of these balls of light. In fact, you know, people think about the vortexes, for example, and one of the people who really popularized vortexes was a lady named Paige Bryant, who was very prominent in Sedona, Arizona in the 1980s. And she really kind of, she was a psychic who got the whole vortex thing going. And then she eventually moved to Western North Carolina, where she wrote a book called The Reawakening of the Great Smoky Mountains, in which she said that there were numerous, quote-unquote, you know, vortex sites or psychic portals or whatever right around Western North Carolina. And I bring this up because she's passed away now, but I spent an evening being entertained by her and her husband, who is an artist, and he had been to Brown Mountain and seen a ball of light with what appeared to be a little person inside of it.
Whoa.
And it inspired him so much that he did artwork, you know, based upon it. So long story short, I mean, I don't know of any stories that are exactly like a Whitley Strieber version of, you know, a bunch of little grays pouring out of some hole and dragging you off. But there are plenty of creepy beings that have been reported around there that would be gray-like, shall we say.
Well, Joshua, it sounds to me like the whole Western North Carolina is one giant Skinwalker ranch.
Yeah, well, you know what's funny is if you start looking back as, you know, throughout history as to why that may be. Okay, so for one thing, the mountains of Western North Carolina are the oldest mountains in North America. Often you'll hear they're the oldest in the world, but I think actually they're the third oldest in the world, but they are the oldest in North America. And of course, if you start in Asheville, North Carolina, where I'm from, you have some of the purest quartz in the world around there. So pure that NASA goes there and uses the quartz for optics and all this sort of thing. If you start drawing a line going east, just a horizontal line going east from Asheville, well, first you pass through Brown Mountain, where you have the Brown Mountain Lights. Then you pass through an area where there's a spot called the Devil's Tramping Ground, where there is this big circle. It's a big barren dirt circle. Nobody can explain why that nothing will grow there. And the rumor has always been, well, the devil, he walks around there in circles at night, musing over the horrible things he's going to do to mankind. And people claim that if you put an object in this circle, that it gets moved outside of it the next day. All right, fine. So you keep drawing this line east. you finally reach the coast of North Carolina, where so many ships have sunk, they call it the graveyard of the Atlantic. That's also where the English first tried to settle on Roanoke Island off the coast of North Carolina. They all vanished, so we now call that the Lost Colony. And you continue drawing that line out into the Atlantic Ocean, and eventually you more or less hit the island of Bermuda, which is one of the top three points of the so-called Bermuda Triangle. And so North Carolina seems to be very specifically aligned with a lot of profound and legendary strange and paranormal phenomena. And so for me to be born there, and by the way, my family on both sides, mom and dad's sides, have been in that area since the late 1700s.
Oh, nice.
It goes to show that it was a very appropriate place for me to be born in order to understand so many different mysteries that are kind of condensed around that area.
Mm-hmm. Well, I've been to Asheville, and it's one of the most beautiful cities out there. I mean, nestled in the Smoky Mountains. Are you kidding me? That whole area is one of the most beautiful places on the planet. But driving through there, Joshua, I noticed that some of the like you drive through a cave or an underpass, it'll say like witch's cave or something. Sometimes there's these kind of names that have to do with Snake Mountain or witch's this or that. I mean, is there witch activity there?
Oh yeah. I mean, you know, and growing up in Asheville, it was just kind of normal to meet people who were involved with some form of witchcraft. And of course, you know, everybody gives it their own little personal spin. Some call it hoodoo or, you know, whatever. But basically it boils down to some kind of a magical ritual manifestation practice. And, you know, what's funny is that I published my first book I wrote it when I was 14. And I published it when I was 15. And because of that book, I got a job writing for the local newspaper when I was 15. So I couldn't even drive my car. My mom and dad had to take me around to all these places where I would do articles and interviews and stuff. And a lot of the stuff that I did was exploring legends and haunted places. So my point is, when I started publishing, my very first book was a book of fictional, scary short stories and poems. And a lot of people accuse me of being, satanic or, you know, into devil worship, because that's not nobody even talks about that kind of stuff anymore. But back then, it was really weird because Western North Carolina is where Billy Graham was from. And so there's a church on every corner, and you have all these very polarized beliefs about sort of fundamentalist Baptist kind of Christianity, and anything that didn't fall directly in line with that was of the devil or evil. And so I had frequently these ridiculous accusations, which are never tossed at me anymore, at that period of time, mm-hmm. where people would say, oh yeah, you know, anything that's not fundamental Southern Baptist Christianity is basically satanic. Mm-hmm. And so I think, ironically, that kind of attracted a lot of people who said, well, you know, we have also this Scots-Irish heritage here, this Gaelic kind of thing, this Celtic-Gaelic kind of thing, and that is pagan. And in fact, you know, Halloween, as we celebrate it today, it's really a Gaelic Celtic celebration that goes back to, you know, Ireland and the areas that we now consider the UK, the way we celebrate it. And so you had this kind of weird dichotomy, because they say there are more people of, for example, Scottish descent in Western North Carolina than there are in Scotland. Mm-hmm. And so you had this very odd relationship between a lot of people who were kind of pagan and Wiccan and kind of looked to that side of life, mm-hmm. that were clashing with the more traditional, you know, Christians. And what you ended up with was a weird mix where you got exposed to a lot of different mindsets and a lot of different viewpoints. And that was kind of the hall of mirrors mm-hmm. that I was raised up in.
Yeah. Yeah. So really, there is a large Christian presence in those mountains for sure. And there is a place here in Indiana similar to that on a much smaller scale called Bloomington, Indiana. That place was nestled in the mountains, or we don't have mountains. They call them mountains, but they're not. They're hills of southern Indiana. And so this town of Bloomington is it was sort of originally brought up just like that, with churches everywhere, fundamentalist churches, apostolic type churches. And then as Indiana University developed there, then in came sort of the Wiccans and the others. And so the economy that you talk about is on a much smaller scale there. But to be fair, though, again, going back to the Asheville area, and similar, I would say, with the Bloomington. So if the fundamentalists would say everything that the Wiccans or another belief system, not just, I don't want to just harp on them. I mean, just any other type of ideology is, say, of the devil. Similarly, wouldn't they say that the Christian beliefs are irrelevant and outdated, and they would have their own understanding to own up to, so to speak, because obviously neither are, you know, I'm just saying there should be some give on that side as well toward those that believe sort of in a biblical context. Wouldn't you think?
Well, yeah, but you know, the thing is, when you really start looking at people's religious beliefs, there are a lot of really interesting paradoxes involved because, well, for one thing, even the various Christian denominations can't agree. You know, I mean, they're supposedly reading the same text, the same ancient text, but they can't agree, you know. So like that's when you go to a bookstore and you see 50 different versions of the Bible and all these different interpretations. It's weird to me that even among people who agree to a certain extent, they still can't agree specifically, you know, with of course, you know, looking at, say, Catholics versus mm-hmm. Protestants and all. Right. But the thing I find most intriguing about all this is that let's say you talk to some politician, and this politician is trying his or her best to just be as neutral as possible and just get votes. And that politician says, oh, yeah, you know, I believe in God and, you know, I go to church. Well, they don't necessarily ever talk about ghosts or spirits or any of that stuff. But every religion pretty much is based upon the concept of a spiritual realm. I mean, that's the whole point of most religions. And I won't say everyone, you know, but mm-hmm. most of the mainstream religions, they're based on the idea that there exists a spiritual realm and that there are other beings in other dimensions, for lack of a better word, mm-hmm. and that if you live a good life, you know, you're going to get to go into this better place. And so all these people are actually embracing a paranormal concept,
correct,
but they somehow sort of fool themselves into thinking that they're not, just because that it's a weird kind of distance that you try to keep mm-hmm. in the mainstream American life. So
yeah.
you see how that's kind of confusing and
really they should be the experts in the supernatural. In fact, L.A. Marzulli calls the Bible the supernatural guidebook, and I would consider myself, Joshua, sort of in the hybrid range, and I believe it. Chase Klosky is sort of that way too, that there is certainly tremendous legitimacy to the writings of the Bible, because there's so many things in there that's been unpacked even today that have been sort of almost covered up by previous church, dare I say, administrations. But also, while saying and acknowledging the truths that are in there, I saw a UFO. You know, I'm out there. I was chased by some kind of large creature down a road that was invisible. So I have, you know, I'm a hybrid, and I think more, you know, you don't need to sort of leave your spiritual biblical base in another room. I think the world is large enough to sort of get the best of those things and move forward in the spiritual context. But let's move on to some more questions for you. Peter from Australia, what do you think about the trailer for the upcoming Ghostbusters Afterlife? A lot of internet fans weren't too happy about it.
Okay, well, you know, obviously, I'm a big fan of the original Ghostbusters. I'm in my 40s, and so, you know, I was at the right age when that came out, so that I'm sure it had a big impact on me and my interest. And, you know, the one that I've seen, and of course, they've only put out one trailer so far, and I'm sure they'll put out two or three more between now and when the movie's released. It appears that they have tried to make it more kid-oriented, and mm-hmm. I understand that from a marketing point of view, but yeah, I didn't get a magical feeling about it. It didn't make me feel some nostalgic, you know, surge of excitement. So mm-hmm. I mean, I think it's too soon to give up hope and to say, oh, okay, this is not going to be good. But the reality is, I think that I was at kind of the right age at the right time to appreciate the first one, and I don't think anything's ever going to top that one for me.
Mm. Well, I'll tell you what, you know, they say never cross the streams, but Josh, I would do it out, just see what happens. You know, I would cross that stream. I would do it. So, all right. So talk about the general area of the Brown Mountains. Do you think there's some would call it a thin place? That's where sort of different worlds are sort of converging and different things would come out of it. You mentioned, what'd you say, Punkin' Man? I mean, look, yeah. we got the Dog Man, we got the Moth Man, we got Punkin' Man, we got Shadow People, we got Bigfoot. I mean, there's all kinds of stuff running around out there, Joshua. What's going on?
Well, you know, I really like that term thin place, and that goes back to, of course, an ancient European term. And the way I view it is, okay, we are, well, okay, if we talk to our best scientists, and as a matter of fact, you know, obviously tonight you invited me to be on video with you, and I told you, unfortunately, I couldn't do that. And the reason is that, I am probably in a unique position, and that is to say that my team and I made the cover of a science journal in 2004. Even though I'm Mr. Paranormal, I have these sort of facilities that still kind of respect the work that I do, and I am therefore able to get access to a lot of properties that would otherwise be kind of off limits. Mm-hmm. And there are people in academia who give me opportunities to go to places and do things, and I don't always have permission to sort of broadcast an image. You know, I can broadcast the sound, but I can't broadcast an image. And so, therefore, when it comes to the kind of work that I do, and by the way, when it comes to your question, could you restate that one more time? Just.
Okay. Well, let's see. We was talking about the thin place and how that general area seems to be, you know, it's almost even referring back to Ghostbusters. You know, the whole theory about that was those buildings had an infrastructure that in the end attracted all these entities. And I'm just wondering, is that general area sort of like in Ghostbusters, they're attracting these creatures and entities there? And what makes that a thin place?
Well, okay, so when it comes to the thin place, I guess what I'm getting at is that there's a tricky, sensitive area that we're kind of dealing with here, where, in other words, there are places here on planet Earth that you can get access to that operate kind of like portals, where things can come through and you can communicate with other things on the other side. But you have to be very, very careful, because this is not something that you just play with, you know. And I am in a position right now where I don't I don't just sort of speculate about these things. Do you know what I mean? Like, I actually have seen enough evidence on my own that there are possibilities for us to interact with other places and other realms. But I have to be sort of careful with how I address those things, because what you also are up against is the possibility that it could be abused in some way. So, for example, let's say if I were to tell you that, okay, I know how you can become invisible, or I know how you can travel through time, or whatever. And you said, that sounds great. Tell me how to do that. And I told you right now how to do that. Well, how many people would abuse that, would take that knowledge and say, you know, you'd have, I'm sure most of the people listening right now would say, well, this is a wonderful thing. This is a great opportunity for me. But there are other people who would take that and do something bad with it. And the great thing about being in my particular position is that, like, for example, 2 days ago, I was at the NASA Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California. So that would have been an example of one of those places where I'm restricted and, you know, I couldn't have said or done certain things while I was there. And I right now am in a – I'm on a property right now where I'm – there are certain things that would be inappropriate for me to say or talk about. But what I can say is that there is extraordinary achievement. There are amazing experiments that are being done right now that are showing us that we are part of an interdimensional environment where if you talk to the smartest physicist out there, okay, the best, the cosmologists and the astrophysicists and the mathematicians, they will tell you there are at least 10 different dimensions. At least. There's probably at least 11 different dimensions that can be mathematically proven. So what does that mean? Well, for one thing, you and I can't actually organically comprehend what that means. I could give you examples like looking at flat land and all that, which is a long conversation for us to get into. If anybody is really that interested, look up Edwin Abbott and Flatland on the internet. But if there are 10 or 11 different dimensions, then that means that we are kind of like, let me put it this way, Daniel. Let's say we have a fish and we call this fish A. And fish A lives 10 feet below the surface of the water. Okay. And then there's fish B that lives 20 feet below the surface of the water. But the water is murky, and they never see each other.
Okay.
But once in a while, there's a big bright sun that comes out, and the waves calm down, and the sun shines through the water, and they get a glimpse of each other, and they freak out. But it's just once in a while, and they have to be at the right place at the right time for that to even happen.
Mm-hmm.
So we are kind of like that, okay? We, and again, this is very, very difficult to try to put into words, but we are those fish, and there are other fish around us, but only under the right circumstances can we perceive each other. And if you take a duck that has lived its whole life floating around on a pond, and you pluck that duck from the pond, and you take it out, and you drop it on top of the water in the Pacific Ocean over top of the Marianas Trench, which is, you know, 30-some thousand feet deep, the duck still thinks it's in a pond. The duck doesn't have any idea about how deep that is. The duck only knows how deep it can go to get its food or whatever.
Okay.
And so what you find is that we are sort of a combination of these two metaphors that I've given, that we don't necessarily know at any given point in time when we are at a place, like a thin place, where the water might be deeper, and even then the conditions have to be right for us to perceive other realms and for those people in those other realms to perceive us. And then there's probably this limited window of physicality when we can interact with each other. So Does that make sense? I mean, I'm really struggling to try to explain some crazy stuff.
No, that was good, and that was deep, and I see the people in live chat really appreciated that. The other day, early in the morning, my wife and I looked up at the sky, and we saw about 45 objects in a row, and they were equally spaced, and it was the first time we ever saw that, and they just kept coming. So before we decided they were an alien invasion, which I have a propensity to do, they're there. I told you. I said, Susan, they're there, right there. We went to the internet and said, okay, what is in the sky in a row flying around planet Earth? Now the closest we came to it was Elon Musk putting a bunch of satellites up at the same time. If that was the case, and do you know, it may not be your forte, but is there something that we get down here when satellites are equally spaced in a row?
Well, you know, here's the thing. Over the years, I have done a heck of a lot of research on how to analyze UFO footage and UFO experiences. And as a matter of fact, for 5 years, I created and produced this event that I used to host a show called Speaking of Strange, which I could still be doing, but these days I don't have time, so I just do a podcast called Joshua P. Warren Daily, and I do it whenever I can, and sometimes it's 5 minutes and sometimes it's an hour, but it's just a daily sort of update on the work that I'm doing. But when I was doing Speaking of Strange, we had the Speaking of Strange UFO experience, and for 5 years I would take all these wonderful, talented hobbyists and engineers out into the countryside, and we'd have a competition. And I would say, you know, you build whatever you can build that will go up into the air and look like a UFO. The only thing is, I mean, it has to actually fly on its own.
Okay.
It has to be safe.
Sure.
And so I saw every type of thing you can imagine. I mean, for 5 years, some of the people blew my mind. As a matter of fact, one of the guys, Jeff Wilson, was so good. He won the competition, I think, at least 2 or 3 years in a row. And his stuff was so good that people started taking pictures of his UFOs and spreading them around on the internet. And people believed that this was real, you know, and I did not promote that, but people just naturally did that, and there was a whole conspiracy that built up around it. Mm-hmm. So my point is, I've spent a lot of time really looking at what humans can do, and these days we have such miniaturized, sophisticated drone technology that analyzing UFO footage has become almost impossible. And, you know, here I am, like I say, in Nevada. And by the way, before I moved here, I called it Nevada, but it's got to be, the locals call it Nevada. It still sounds a little weird to me. But here in Nevada, okay, next to Area 51 and all of the research and experimentation and all the exotic stuff that's going on here, and you see, you know, Senator Harry Reid, who is from Nevada, you know, writing letters talking about all the exotic stuff. When you look at all that and you see some of this stuff that's flying around, I mean, you have to say, okay, this is getting too complicated now. If you could go back to, say, the year 1900 and look up at the sky and see what you just described, Daniel, well, then you'd know, okay, that ain't supposed to be there, right?
Right.
But now, you tell me you see these things. Gosh, there are a lot of things, mm-hmm. a lot of explanations that could be in place. So it's very frustrating. It's cool to know that we're at the point where we can put that kind of stuff in the air. Mm-hmm. But I can't directly give you a good mm-hmm. explanation for what you may have seen there, because there are many possibilities.
Okay. And for anyone watching the show, if you've seen those, I guess we'll call them satellites at this point, whatever they were, objects equally spaced in a row, maybe 40 to 50 of them. So the one caveat on this story, Joshua, is that while we were watching, several others appeared out of the line of, let's just say, quote unquote, satellites. They were coming on out of the line, and then they made a left turn and headed south. And they came from exactly the same point. So I'm just wondering, wait a minute now. I think satellites, I don't know if they have an onboard thrust system, but I don't think they do. So there you go. See, I've got it. Those definitely the alien invasion right there. Doreen from the live chat says, Joshua P. Warren, will there be disclosure in 2020?
Well, you know, honestly, I believe there already has been disclosure. Mm-hmm. If you have been following what has been happening since 2017, I mean, the disclosure has already taken place. I mean, basically, here's what I'm talking about. The Pentagon has already admitted that, yes, we've been working on this project. We're back engineering, quote-unquote, exotic materials, which, of course, we know mostly as the ATIP project. Right. And then you have this letter that I mentioned that Senator Harry Reid, when he was the Senate Majority Leader, wrote to the Department of Defense asking for more security clearance more security protocol, which, and if you go to my website, joshuapwarren.com, there's no period after the P, joshuapwarren.com, you can scroll down the homepage there and find a link to this PDF of this letter where he was saying, we have exotic technology that has relevance to weaponry, propulsion, communications, and we don't want our adversaries to get it. Okay, so that means he says we found this. We've discovered it. In other words, like, we didn't come up with it. We found it. And we don't want our adversaries to get it. So, okay, where the heck did it come from then? So it obviously came from somewhere else. And then you have Robert Bigelow in Las Vegas, who was one of the primary people contracted to back engineer this stuff, who gets on 60 Minutes, interviewed by Laura Logan, and Laura Logan, the reporter, says to him, so if we go into space, are we going to encounter aliens? And he laughs and says, we don't have to go to space. They're already right here under our noses. I mean, he said this on 60 Minutes on CBS. I could keep going,
yeah.
But my point is, disclosure has happened already.
Yeah.
And if you're not keeping up with this, if all you're doing is getting your news from Fox or CNN or whatever, well, you're not getting real news. You're just getting, you know, some kind of corporate stuff. So disclosure has happened.
Right. That, I mean, that Tic Tac video is pretty much disclosure right there. But let me ask you something. So you're out west right now. Okay, you've got Area 51, you've got Roswell, you've got Groom Lake. Then you go over back to western North Carolina, and you've got the Brown Mountain Lights. You got Dog Man and Pumpkinhead guys running around. So which one has more freaky mysteries going there? You've been able to look at both of them. Which one do you like better?
Well, you know, not only that, I spent a good 15 years in the Bermuda Triangle for 5 years. I lived in Puerto Rico and was the owner and director of the and creator of the Bermuda Triangle Research Center there. So, yeah, I mean, like, you know, I've seen a lot of stuff. I mean, you know, I've been to Europe and Central America and studied pyramids. So I believe that, okay, well, my journey has led me here to Nevada. Okay, of all the stuff that I've done, my journey has led me here. I am here at this point in time, at this place, because this is where technology is being sort of aggregated and condensed and turned into something practical. Okay, so... yeah, we have strange, interesting, exotic stuff occurring all around this planet. I mean, as a matter of fact, if you want to look at it from a big point of view, if you take some scientist who is just a strict atheist, skeptical debunker, okay, a person who doesn't believe in anything other than the material, the nuts and bolts, but that scientist goes out there with the biggest budgets and the biggest telescopes and looks far and wide, that scientist currently, that mainstream scientist, will turn around and say, you know what? there is no other place that we can find that is like Earth. Earth is a paranormal planet. You know, normal is one thing. Paranormal means abnormal. So even those scientists who don't believe in anything will say that Earth is a paranormal place. And the fact that you and I are talking to each other right now, and we live in a house, and there's a McDonald's down the road, and we get in our car, and we, you know, I mean, this is so ridiculous that we do all this stuff here, and yet we look out there with the brightest minds and the biggest budgets, and we don't see, supposedly, anything like this, okay? So we are living on a paranormal planet. All of this paranormal data from around this planet is currently being condensed right here into Nevada. Okay, this wow. is that. That's why I say the United States government owns 86% of this state. That's one of the reasons that I'm here. That's the kind of research that's being done here. And as a matter of fact, if you ever come to Las Vegas, I have a show called the Creepy Vegas Ghost and UFO Show
wow.
that we do every Saturday. I created it, I own it, but I usually am traveling or whatever, so I don't always get to host it. Mm-hmm. The host is a man who is named Nick Weird. His name is actually
what?
Nick Weir, but we added the D on the end, so okay. it's weird. Okay. It's perfect. He's a local. And if you come here, it costs $19.95. Okay, nothing in Vegas costs $19.95. It's a forum for us to get together and share what we're doing with people. So if you go to creepyvegas.com, you'll find out how you can get a ticket and come, and we show you all this footage of ghosts and UFOs, and we have haunted objects. We have debris from Roswell that you can touch. You can take your picture with all this stuff. And so, again, long answer to your question is what I've given you, but the short answer is you got to come here to Las mm-hmm. Vegas.
When you mentioned sort of the group of people that don't believe there's anything more than what the senses have revealed to us, to our mm-hmm. biological inner workings, those people, I feel so sorry for them. And I like what the chatter said, the world is a much more interesting place with entities running around. I'd much rather talk to somebody who's maybe diametrically opposed to me sort of in a spiritually way, but they believe in something else. Maybe they believe in rocks or who knows what, you know. I would have a better conversation with them because I could relate to them in a spiritual context about the unseen world than I can with somebody who says there's nothing other than what you see. I think those people are really just leading miserable lives in and of themselves. But I was just thinking of the movie Big Trouble in Little China, where Jack Burton says, a man have to be some kind of fool to believe we're all alone in this universe. And I always thought that was one of the funnier lines in there. All right, let's get to another question for you, Joshua P. Warren. We have, this is from Peter again. Has any progress been made to hear EVPs in real time, i.e. they're usually recorded?
Okay, well, Peter, thank you for that question once again. You know, I am one of the biggest critics of EVP, and that takes a lot of people by surprise, because you'd think that, you know, I, doing the kind of work that I have done, I wrote a book called How to Hunt Ghosts that was published almost 20 years ago, and it's by Simon and Schuster, and it's multiple languages around the world, and people think that I'm just going to take for granted that any weird little sound is an EVP. But I actually I don't see a lot of value in 99% of EVP. For one thing, if you're going to have an audio recording, well, why not have a video with it? You know. But nonetheless, stomach growls and feet shuffling and all these things get exaggerated yeah. so much. One of my best friends is a man named Dean Worsing, and he is a bona fide instructor of EVP at a bona fide college in Maryland. And we have discussions all the time where we're going back and forth and analyzing these sounds. And most of the time, they just don't live up to my expectations. Now, I have captured some myself that are clear as a bell. But my requirement is, if you stop somebody on a sidewalk, you know, on the side of the street, and you play it for them without telling them what it's supposed to say, are they going to be able to get it? If they can, well, that's a good EVP. That should be your reference point. And most of the stuff that gets produced is just not up to snuff for me. And so I am doing some new experiments over the next week, as a matter of fact, with a new technique that might be helpful for capturing EVP. But altogether, I don't see a lot of value in it, to be honest with you.
Yeah. Back to my glamping escapade. I've been over time deliberately making myself aware, trying to be more perceptive of things around me. You know, now I'm not just, you know, looking for fun and entertainment. I just want to know if something is around me, if there's something happening that I can't see. I don't want to just go bumbling through life from point A to B and that's the end of it. I want to experience what life is showing me that I can't see because, say, you know, I'm thinking about Walmart, some kind of crazy thing like that. So we were in the forest, and so I was listening to see what was in the forest, and it was getting toward the evening, and I heard something. I heard something in the forest making a sound. I said, okay, what's making that sound? Well, my wife Susan called out to it, and it responded. And we did it several times. I got my phone out. It was windy, though, and so the wind's on there. I can hear it in there, and I haven't got to my audio software to try to filter that out. Maybe I can pick it up. But there was something in there responding to her call to something out there. And the reason I point that out is because that's what I've been saying on the show for some time, is that there's a lot going on. And if you sort of unlearn what society does, you know, it's like children in the beginning, they say they see people, whatever, they have a ability to perceive things until we talk them out of it. And then later, I guess when we get near death, then it's almost as if that's revived, and people tell you in hospice situations, people are talking to their relatives or somebody. Of course, right there, somebody will immediately say, well, it's a demon, but you know, maybe not, maybe it is, I don't know. But they say they see things, and that's been well documented. In fact, my own brother, that happened to him. He said he saw, they had a previous brother die, and he was getting ready to die, and he said that he saw his brother in the room. Oh, my brother too, actually. And so, you know, I'm just saying that you might be able to see or hear things that's going around that may be of interest. And you know, to me, it's just it's good to know that it's almost like reconnecting to your spirituality when you do that.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, that's the whole point. You know, people who often will sort of turn up their noses at the idea of paranormal investigation, I think often rightfully do so, because any Tom, Dick, or Harry can run around out there and say, I'm a paranormal investigator. I mean, you don't have to get a stamp of approval. And so you have a lot of insane people out there who say, I'm a paranormal this or that. And you just have to size up everybody on a case-per-case basis. But the important thing to remember is that we are the dominant power here in the United States of America. We're the dominant, you know, worldwide power, because that we rely so much on the scientific method. And the scientific method has some serious flaws. I mean, for example, I can't scientifically prove that I love somebody or I hate somebody. I can't scientifically prove what I dreamed last night, even though, you know, that was an experience that was real to me. As a matter of fact, most of history is not really scientifically proven. I mean, there are people who tell me that George Washington lived, but I never met him. And as a matter of fact, I never met any of those people who said he lived, you know. So, I mean, most of human history is based upon something that you can't put under a microscope. It's just based upon what humans have passed along, oral tradition or, you know, whatever. And so that said, you have to understand that the value of the scientific method is that it's based upon the idea that we don't know everything, and that we are in a position to explore, that we are curious, that there is a bunch of stuff that we don't know. And if you talk to some of those most intelligent cosmologists and astrophysicists, they'll tell you that over 95% of the so-called known universe consists of dark matter and dark energy, which is defined by the very fact that we have no clue what it is. And so if even our scientists are admitting that we don't know what over 95% of all this is, why not just say, okay, let's be honest and get real here, guys. We don't know what's going on here. And so the scientific method is very effective because of the success that we've been able to demonstrate, and yet the paranormal investigation format is really the fundamental foundation of the scientific process. And so instead of people being at odds, you know, seeing like science at odds with paranormal and calling it pseudoscience and all that crap, basically what people should be doing is realizing that it's about logic. It is about a certain system of viewing cause and effect and being rational, and that the paranormal is the basis for the scientific method, because the paranormal acknowledges that the world is a vast, mysterious place, and we still have a heck of a lot to learn.
Well, that's a truism if I've ever heard one. You know, Joshua, in the first hour I said that basically like a Bible-believing Christian should be a supernatural expert. And I was thinking one of the stories that represents that in the Bible is that the disciples saw Jesus after he was resurrected, and they said, hey, look, there's a ghost. And you know why they said that Jesus was a ghost? It's because they believed in ghosts. They've seen ghosts. That was 2,000 years ago that they knew that they've been experiencing ghost activity, and it's written right in the Bible. That's what Christians should be the experts in that situation. Now, Joshua, you've got a number of books, and I've got some screen grabs. I don't want to go in great detail, but I want to hit a couple of them because they piqued my interest pretty good. And let me go to the first one, and this is called Pet Ghosts. What is going on with that book?
Yeah, well, you know, that's a great memory for me, because I published over 20 books, and Pet Ghost, honestly, the name's a little bit misleading, because the publisher came up with the name Pet Ghost because they thought it would be a good seller, and that gives you the impression that it's only about dogs and cats. But actually, that book is about non-human apparitions in general. So I'm talking everything from insects to dinosaur ghosts.
An insect ghost?
I mean, like, the whole range of you know, I came up with the term phantomals, which is basically a ghostly animal looking apparition. So that would include like black dogs, or even possibly cryptids like Bigfoot or the Loch Ness Monster. You know, getting back to Bigfoot, you know, you asked me about him earlier. I think that it's very possible that Bigfoot is some kind of an interdimensional being. And the reason I say that, and I know there's a lot of contention about this, and, you know, is he flesh and blood or whatever? Well, look, here's my view from everything I've learned and all the, I mean, and again, I'm not one of these guys who gets on the internet and does a search and says, oh, I'm an expert now because I looked up a Wikipedia article. No, I get out there and I do research. And so I can tell you that, in my opinion, if there were a physical, biological ape that's, well, let's say 8 feet tall, you know, 1,200 pounds or whatever, running around this country, then there would be more evidence, okay? There would be more hair, there would be more scat, there would be more footprints. That's not believable. Mm-hmm. But I do believe people see this thing. And the only way you can reconcile that is to say that Bigfoot is not a normal biological organism. That Bigfoot is something that, I don't know if interdimensional is the right word, but something that behaves dramatically different than, say, a gorilla. Okay. Mm-hmm. A gorilla takes a hell of a lot of food to survive every day, and we won't get into all that right now. But in Pet Ghosts, I actually sort of dig in to these kinds of issues as well. And so it's about the spectrum of life in general. And so I'm glad you asked me about that, because I wish more people would read that book.
Yeah, well, you know, you might be the first person that you kind of went through it earlier. You said something about insects. Now, an insect ghost, this is something that I've been pondering. I need to do an investigation myself, because, Joshua, over the years, I have been bitten by stuff, and when I look, it's not there. So now I know what it is. It's a daggone ghost insect. And I bet people in the live chat have been bitten by these things, too. Have you ever been bitten by something? You look down, you go, ow, you look down, there's nothing there?
I lived in Puerto Rico for 5 years. I've been bitten by a lot of stuff.
Okay. All right. Well, that's good, man. Ghost insect. I love it. All right. What about this scary looking dude called Don't Play With Robert, the world's most haunted doll? What's going on with that freak?
Yeah. You know, if you go to my website, again, it's just my name, joshuapwarren.com, and you go to the curiosity shop, one of the things you can get is a collection of some of my e-books. And because, you know, some of the books that I've written have been like 400 pages, but then I don't sit down and read a 400 page book. I don't have that much of an attention span. But so sometimes I write books that are, you know, smaller and to the point, and I put them together into a nice little collection. And one of them is, yeah, Don't Play With Robert, the World's Most Haunted Doll. And that's about Robert the Haunted Doll, who lives in a museum now in Key West, Florida. I think he is the most famous haunted doll in the world. And we could do a whole show about Robert, but in a nutshell, the doll is over 100 years old. And basically, he has a spirit inside of him. And if you go up to him and you take his picture without asking for permission, well, guess what? Bad things are going to happen to you. And there are probably, I'm sure, at least over 1,000 letters of apology plastered all over the walls of his little room, where people have done, you know, they've just taken this snidely, and they have taken his picture, and bad stuff happens to him.
I won't do it. Hey, you know how I get around those 400 page books? I just give them to my wife to read them, and she gives me the highlights.
You get the cliff notes?
Yes,
you know what?
It's great.
I actually do that with my wife. My wife, Lauren, and I have been together for 22 years.
Oh, look at you.
And she can just devour a book in like 2 days. I can't do that. I can write a book. It takes me like a year or two to write a book, but I can't sit down and devour a book in 2 or 3 days. She can do that. And so a lot of times somebody will send me a book, I'll say, Lauren, read that and tell me the good parts.
Yeah. I've got over the years, I've been doing this 2004. You can imagine the amount of books that I've been sent by authors and publicists and various things. And in that collection, I mean, I might as well start a little shop too, like Robert Biddle, or you seem like you may have a shop too, but, you know, just fill it with those books. Well, all right, then we got another book. What's this thing? And speaking of Robert Biddle, this The Gringo Maniac Murder Spree. What in the world?
Well, thank you for asking about that. You know what? I get interviewed all the time. You know that. And you're actually the very first person who has brought that book up. And I'm glad, because I love it. I've written two novels. And The Gringo Maniac Murder Spree was a novel that I wrote when I was in Puerto Rico. And I saw all of these bizarre things. I mean, Puerto Rico has so much paranormal phenomena condensed in a relatively small space. I mean, the island is 100 miles from east to west and about 35 miles from north to south. And yet you have, I mean, super extreme UFOs and USOs and cryptids and ghosts and all this stuff sort of condensed there. And I wanted to come up with a dramatic way of connecting all this together. And so I came up with a story about a guy who is there to supposedly go around the island and murder people for a particular reason, which, you know, we don't have time to get into. But I turned it into this kind of ruthless, Quentin Tarantino, Robert Rodriguez type novel. It's got a lot of foul language in it. It's got a lot of graphic violence. As a matter of fact, when I sent it to the first publisher, even before then, I sent it to my agent. My agent said, this is too violent. So it's not for everybody. But it eventually got published. And it's just like one of those page turning, like, crazy novels. And if you're into the paranormal, you're going to go on, like, this almost sort of boring, sweeping whirlwind of paranormal event to paranormal event. But at the same time, it has this sort of tense, suspenseful action plot in the middle of it. So I don't know, all the reviews have been good on Amazon, so that's from people who actually read it.
Okay, yeah, that reminded me of a, you talk about graphic violence, we watch this movie sometimes called Cabin Fever, and in it, these kids in this cabin, they set this guy on fire, and he goes running off, and we just laugh because the guy's set on fire. But then they eventually say, hey, man, it's getting ready to rain, and rain to put him out, you know. But so, I mean, all graphic violence isn't necessarily, you know, like, you know, I mean, unreadable. I mean, I'm sure there's a lot you can read here. Now, this is going to make a lot of people nervous, but going to put it up there anyway. What's this Use the Force book?
Oh yeah, you know that's, I think I'm probably prouder of that book than anything I've ever written. And just curious, why would that make people nervous?
Well, I see that you have the law of attraction, and I think that right there it's kind of a dividing point for some people. Say there is no such thing, or
I see what you mean. Well, you know, yeah. So, well, for one thing, I was always a big Star Wars fan. Because, you know, again, I was sort of a kid of the 70s or whatever. And so I loved Star Wars as a reference point for what a lot of people who, I mean, like, let's get real here, Daniel. You know, we all know there are a lot of flaky people out there who talk about the law of attraction. And the bottom line is, I look at this, though, from a more engineering standpoint. And so here's where I'm coming from.
Okay.
If you have... let's say a guy who walks into a room that is empty except for two identical pianos.
Okay.
And he goes up to one piano and he bangs a chord on one piano. That second piano is going to also play that same chord, even though he never goes near it. And that is a concept called sympathetic resonance. Mm. And this is the basis for traditional broadcasting. And so what this shows you, and you can get on YouTube and look this up. You can take a tuning fork and you can strike it and then hold an identical tuning fork near it, and it'll start ringing even if you don't touch it. What this means is that when you send literally a vibration out into the universe, it will activate a corresponding vibration that is sent back to you. And this is something that's physically demonstrable. So you might hear stories about karma or whatever, and you might think, okay, well, this is just some kind of abstract concept. But no, I'm telling you, there are physical precepts here which basically confirm you can use this if you know the proper techniques. And so I went through and I watched all the movies and I read all the books about what is called law of attraction, going all the way back to the 1800s when Madame Blavatsky was writing about it. And I used Star Wars as a pop culture reference point in order to help people visualize what I was talking about. And you don't have to be a Star Wars fan. The book has great reviews. You can go to Amazon and see the reviews. And a lot of the people who read it are not into Star Wars at all, but it's helpful to have those images from Star Wars, but it's not necessary. And I took the best information that I have gathered throughout my life in order to learn how to manifest and materialize wonderful things. And I put this into this handbook. And I'm telling you, this book, I could talk to you for an hour about how I wrote this and all the synchronistic things that came together for me to do this. Mm-hmm. But if you read this book, your life will be better. Mm-hmm. And I'm not telling you that because I'm going to make a fortune off of it. You can probably get it for free if you go to Amazon. If you have, you know, like Prime or whatever, you can probably download the Kindle for free. You just, if you read this book, it's the best of what I know, and it has made my life what it is today, and I hope it helps everybody else.
Well, I've been trying to manifest $100,000. It's not working, so maybe I might need to get the book.
Well, yes, you should. So, because money is one of the big things, of course, that everybody wants to manifest, and I talk a lot about that. And you know what? It's a serious issue. I mean, you got to have money to live, and I understand that, and I'm telling you, this will help you manifest that $100,000.
Mm-hmm. All right. And then to sort of exit on out of the evening broadcast, we've got the Brown Mountain Light book in our background right now. What's in that book?
So this is something that everybody can read for free. If you go to brownmountainlights.com, all spelled out, brownmountainlights.com, the site honestly needs to be updated. I'm a very busy guy. I have many different companies and projects, and so I haven't had time to really bring it up to date. But if you go to brownmountainlights.com and you scroll down, you'll see an area where you can download a PDF of this book. It's more of a booklet that I wrote called Brown Mountain Lights, a Viewing Guide. And it has the complete history of the Brown Mountain Lights and theories about what they are and tips for what you need to do if you want to go there and increase your chances of seeing them. It's a very easy read. There are lots of pictures. And again, you just go there. You don't have to sign up for anything or log in for anything. You just go to Brown Mountain Lights and download that. Mm-hmm. But if you're going to go anywhere, I hope you'll go to joshuapwarren.com and sign up for my free e-newsletter. It takes you about 2 seconds. You put your email address in there, hit the button, and then that way I'll be able to communicate with you directly. I sit down with my own fingers here, and I'll let you know what's happening with my new experiments if you sign up for the e-newsletter, joshuapwarren.com.
All right, let me just get one final question from Ray. He says, your portable device, the radionics device, when one can insert a photo, would it work if they inserted a MEM card like a SanDisk with a digital photo?
You know what? I've never gotten that question before. Wow, you're breaking some records here tonight, Daniel. I got to tell you. You know, the wishing machine is a whole different ballgame. Wishingmachineproject.com has a lot of free information, educational information, to explain to everybody what the wishing machine is about. And basically, okay, what you want to do is represent what you want in some form that connects with you emotionally. So for me, seeing a physical image, in other words, seeing a physical picture or whatever, that helps me. So for me, I wouldn't want to put like a chip or some kind of, you know, something like that in there because it's not visual enough. But I see no reason why that it shouldn't be effective as long as you personally are able to look at that chip and see the picture in your mind, because everything that you do in your life starts with a picture. If you have a table next to you right now, well, guess what? That began somewhere in the past as an image in somebody's mind, and now it's a physical thing.
Mm. All right, and final question is going to come from me. We started off the program, Joshua P. Warren, talking about the alien abduction movie they produced. Did you meet any of the actors?
No, I did not. The director, Matty Beckerman, I have a museum in Asheville, North Carolina, in the basement of the Asheville Masonic Temple. And the very first place it was located in, however, was an old jailhouse. And so at that time, Matty Beckerman and his crew, they came to the old jailhouse, and they brought in probably a crew of about half a dozen people, and they set me up in the corner of one of the rooms, and I did my interview, and probably took us 2 or 3 hours, and I did my interview. I had to sign some paperwork. They gave me a check, and then I didn't hear anything for like 2 years.
Wow.
And then all of a sudden, boom, this movie comes out.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Joshua P. Warren, I appreciate you coming on the program. That's phenomenal what you said. We first contacted each other about 10 years ago, but synchronicity and time merged us on the same path at the right time. Whatever that was, it wasn't the right time. This is obviously the right time. Joshua P. Warren, I know you're very busy, but in the future, can we have you back on the program?
I'd love to. I've enjoyed it immensely, and thank you very much for having me. You have a wonderful show here, Daniel.
All right. I appreciate you, too, and have a Merry Christmas.
Okay, same to you, my friend.
All right, good evening.